John.
Noi siamo tutti molto lieti e molto contenti di questa opportunità che il professor Sporting, la pronuncia esatta, no?
Sì.
È un po' all'italiana, e ci ha concesso. Siamo tutti e tre insieme per una serie di ragioni, come dire, che hanno a che vedere con diverse cose. Io e il professor Purini, o meglio il professor Purini e il sottoscritto, hanno partecipato per circa 8 giorni molto intensamente ad un workshop negli Stati Uniti, alla New York Institute of Technology, NYIT, di New York. Siamo stati insieme per una settimana lavorando sul tema della Roosevelt Island e abbiamo conosciuto anche l'atmosfera della scuola, i professori della scuola. Entrambi abbiamo fatto una conferenza in questa occasione. Fra gli altri colleghi che abbiamo conosciuto in questo periodo c'era appunto il professor Sporting, che ci ha fatto un omaggio a entrambi molto importante e molto gradito, che è questo bellissimo volume che potete nel frattempo vedere, perché noi lo conosciamo bene, e che è un poco, come dire, io ho riassunto un po' quasi il libro di una vita, o comunque di un aspetto, di una passione di una vita, perché chiaramente il professor Sporting ha una grandissima passione e conoscenza e studio sulla nostra città di Roma, attraverso un filone che è un filone di studio e di analisi della città, che ha un nome tutelare dell'analisi, diciamo, nuova, innovativa sulla morfologia urbana, che è Colin Rowe, personaggio, diciamo, di caratura internazionale, che ha dato uno sguardo nuovo. E questo bellissimo libro, come voi vedrete, rivela una Roma sconosciuta, perché a questo serve il disegno, come spiegavo oggi ai miei studenti. Il disegno non serve a raccontare quello che confusamente vediamo, ma serve a far capire delle strutture nascoste della realtà, delle strutture non presenti, che diventano delle armi fondamentali dell'interpretazione, dell'apprezzamento e poi della progettazione. È un filone, una sorta di filone continuo che va dalla riscoperta, quasi direi radiografica, di alcune strutture della realtà che vengono effettivamente rivelate, che non sono conosciute prima, che sono analizzate, sono messe in una catena, diciamo, di ragionamenti che per gli architetti sono assolutamente fondamentali, perché sono la stessa insieme di processi che arriveranno al progetto. E questa è la grande differenza tra personaggi che analizzano la realtà dei tessuti urbani con questa logica. Noi in Italia naturalmente non possiamo non pensare a Saverio Muratori, ovviamente, con un occhio in cui l'interpretazione dei tessuti o dei fatti storici, eccetera, è un occhio, come dire, che si protrae dalla lettura della città alla progettazione. E questa è una caratteristica comune a questa scuola, con tutte le differenze che ci sono. Un'altra cosa vorrei aggiungere: il professor Sporting ha un curriculum molto ricco di onori e onorificenze, sia nell'ambito accademico sia nell'ambito professionale. Ha più di un sodalizio professionale in una lunga fase con Meyer, precedentemente e dopo autonomamente, quindi è, come dire, un personaggio intellettuale a noi molto vicino e molto prossimo, ecco perché c'è con noi il professor Purini, che ha molte caratteristiche simili. Cioè è una persona che opera contemporaneamente nel livello dell'interpretazione della realtà attraverso il disegno, nel suo caso in una scuola di pensiero particolare, in un livello di ricerca e di insegnamento e in un livello di progettazione attiva. Quindi per tutto questo insieme di ragioni è una sorta di luogo particolarmente significativo per noi, e la presenza del professor Curini è probabilmente quello della personalità di maggior spicco che in questo momento possiamo mettere in campo per intercettare alcuni di questi livelli, oltre al fatto che abbiamo condiviso questa, diciamo, occasione. Quindi adesso io darei la parola a Curini, poi tu fai esattamente quello che vuoi, e io ti traduco ogni tanto, e poi lasciamo la parola di nuovo al professor Curini, al professor Barbera, agli altri intervenuti, ai dottorandi, agli amici, a chi vuole rispondere. Va bene? Sì. Prego.
Sono lieto che il professore sia qui. Ho letto il suo libro con attenzione e vorrei, diciamo, elencare semplicemente, senza entrare nel merito, che ormai parliamo discorso dopo, alcuni aspetti che sono secondo me importanti. La cosa importante anche di Roma, di Monte Roma, la serie di elementi conoscitivi che il libro propone, la genesi formativa di alcune parti del centro storico, il passaggio ad esempio dall'architettura assertiva, diciamo, del tutto in qualche modo astratta del primo Cinquecento all'architettura barocca, che invece costruisce quelli che Caravaggio chiama teatri, parla di situazioni ambientali complete di sapore scenografico che coinvolgono interi brani del tessuto urbano, e quindi questo è importante, questo elemento conoscitivo nuovo che la lettura che lui fa di Roma ci propone, una lettura sostanzialmente anche della genesi di tutte le città, in particolare appunto di Roma. Poi un altro aspetto molto importante del libro è considerare gli edifici come testi complessi. L'edificio non è soltanto una fabbrica edilizia in cui si fanno, si svolgono alcune funzioni, ma è come un libro, cioè ha diversi contenuti, diversi significati, stratificati, sono rapporti, alcuni anche contraddittori, quindi afferrare, comprendere la nozione testuale di un'opera architettonica diventa fondamentale per capire anche le relazioni che ha l'architettura con altri aspetti delle attività urbane. E questo è molto, molto interessante anche vedendo come le parole si alternano le illustrazioni, che non sono un elemento che spiega gli argomenti, ma un testo parallelo fatto di immagini che possono chiarire in modo esemplare le ragioni dell'architettura, come l'architettura si fa. Questo sulla scorta ovviamente di un maestro dell'autore che è stato Colli Rowe, riprende la lezione straordinaria di Vicover, che Vicover dà nel suo libro del 1949, Principi architettonici dell'Stato dell'Umanesimo, riprende questa grande indicazione dello storico tedesco-americano e la applica alla città antica e contemporanea in uno smosi problematico che annulla quella differenza che il movimento moderno aveva posto all'inizio tra città storica e città contemporanea. Colli Rowe dimostra che queste due città si devono intrecciare, si devono scambiare valori e si può costruire una città, appunto, la Colland City, che è una sintesi di questa simbiosi. Volevo ricordare che l'insegnamento di Colli Rowe è stato fondamentale anche per architetti come Ungers, come Lewis, come altri architetti italiani come Molino e altri.
Sì, Eisenman.
Sì, Eisenman proprio. Eisenman fece un viaggio, un famoso viaggio negli anni 50 a Roma, dove scoprì uno degli architettori che più lo hanno impressionato, diciamo, e poi che più lo hanno interessato, che è Santa Maria di Campidelli, che compagna anche in questo libro, ovviamente. Poi l'ultimo cosa che voglio dire è che perché è importante secondo me questo libro oggi? Perché questo libro smentisce, si oppone a quello divorzio tra architettura e città che sta provocando in tutto il mondo una serie di autentici, secondo me, disastri urbani. Cioè l'architettura deve avere un rapporto intrinseco con la città, e questo rapporto purtroppo è stato infranto dall'architettura, diciamo, spettacolare dell'ultimo trentennio. Guardare una fotografia qualsiasi di città come Pechino, Shanghai o altre, anche europee, e di accorgere di quanto danno questo atteggiamento sta producendo alle nostre vite. Passeggiare nel centro di Roma o passeggiare a Shanghai, ecco, dimostra diciamo, la fine di un sistema di relazioni straordinarie. Quello della città è un organismo vivente, tutto ciò è per ora perduto, ma questo libro ci indica come si potrebbe recuperare. L'unica cosa che chiederei, ma poi la chiederò magari anche quando a meglio alla fine della sua lezione, è una certa assenza nel suo libro del pensiero tiranesiano. E te lo capisco perché il pensiero tiranesiano è il pensiero che a metà del Settecento sgretola proprio quel rapporto tra città e architettura che andiamo ancora una volta cercando di ricordare. E forse è una diciamo, un'assenza premeditata e necessaria. Grazie.
Prego.
Grazie.
Vado a vedere le immagini.
Sì, io lo aiuto se serve. Poi lo senti bene. Yes.
Buongiorno a tutti. I'm sorry I'm going to speak in English because non parlo italiano bene. But and I'd like to thank Antonino Saggio for inviting me to do this and also for the opportunity to meet Franco Purini in New York with Antonino and on the occasion of being at our school, I have this occasion to talk to you today. So it's been very nice that that transaction could happen. The mention of Piranesi is interesting. And I have to think about how we kind of answer that issue. But it's been mentioned, I published this book. I actually started this, and I was just thinking about it now, 50 years ago, when I was at the American Academy in Rome for 2 years. And I had, as part of being a fellow at the Academy, a project to do. So I did this project, which I published as an article, but I kept working on it in my teaching. And for all of you that are architects, you know it's much easier to draw things than it is to write things. So it's been a long time trying to write this book. There are two things. One is the being at the American Academy, 1968 to 70, and the other, as has been mentioned, that I was a student of Colin Rowe at Cornell University just before that, and those two things are sort of critical to what I've tried to produce. In my studies, and this is very different from yours, I think, because of the kind of media that you have. When we studied architectural history, buildings were presented mostly in a Germanic method of
Germanic.
Like,
good. Yeah.
Bitcoin, etc. With buildings in isolation, because they discussed the buildings, they had these beautiful Alinari photographs, which even corrected the perspective, so that not only was the building distorted to a perfect view, but there was nothing around them in our history books. And when I came to Rome, I found these buildings were in a much more complex and interesting urban settings. And with further observation and analysis, the design decisions seemed to be made in relation to contextual conditions, that there was a give and take between the building and its setting.
Okay. What do you think? Do I translate?
Sure.
Volete vi traduco 30 secondi oppure siete tranquillissimi? Come volete? C'è qualcuno che sente l'esigenza che sia tradotto un poco in italiano? O avete...
Una sintesi non va bene.
una brevissima sintesi, proprio brevissima, credo che la cosa che lui ha, il professore ha sottolineato, io ho detto è un libro di una vita, ma non pensavo che la prima ideazione fosse 50 anni fa, perché il professore, tra l'altro, e di questo parleremo dopo, condivide l'esperienza dell'American Academy, di cui io sono un fortunato advisor, quindi la conosco dall'interno. Come sapete, all'Accademia Americana vengono architetti trentenni per studiare Roma e fare dei progetti su Roma. Lui 50 anni fa, nel 68-69, è stato per 2 anni. E in qualche maniera il nusce di questo libro data quindi 50 anni fa il suo progetto all'Accademia Americana, di cui poi, se vogliamo, parliamo. E poi ha detto questa cosa abbastanza interessante, che, come dire, questo tipo di lavoro si mette in un momento culturale in cui ancora il disegno di norma era più visto relazionato all'oggetto singolo, lui aveva usato la parola germanico per dire questa cosa un po' positivistica, piuttosto che al contesto e alle relazioni. Quindi, diciamo, il suo lavoro si innesta in questa problematica.
When I started to teach in the 70s at Columbia University, I began a program to bring students to Rome. And for 12 years, we came to Rome to work on projects that I had proposed from my thinking while I was at the American Academy. And through what I would call observation, documentation, and analysis, we did studies of the contextual relationships of the significant buildings in Rome to their place. And so the students drew drawings, which are the second half of the book. They're all, you don't know this, technique, ink on Mylar drawings, big ink on Mylar drawings, handmade drawings, which were attempting to be new drawings, drawings that didn't exist that would connect the historical depiction of Rome, Roman buildings, in their context. So the purpose of the book, in one sense, is to share this amazing documentation, and also, I think, the ideas that are embedded in them. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, through my learning at Cornell with Colin Rowe, in his urban design program at Rome, and in Rome, I developed some theories about the potential processes of urban designing. And I have to say that I'm deeply indebted to Colin Rowe for this, but I must say that, and I must say that it started with my being a student and the thinking and teaching of Rowe. So that's a context that I think is important for you to know. The book and the presentation that I want to make goes from the specific to very general ideas about urban design. To specific case studies in relationship to urban buildings and their context. Okay, I'm going to make a change.
Yeah, go. I will take that.
Okay, because now I want to talk about a theory, my theory from my observations over this time, which are in the first part of the book. And I begin with the word idea, and some relation to Plato's discussion of the idea as the ideal and its relation to things, which are imperfect examples of it. This is general knowledge. But ideal is defined in the dictionary as a concept of what is perfect, existing in the imagination, desirable or perfection, but not likely to become reality. And that's important, for idea not to become reality. So the dialectical opposite of the ideal is the real. The real existing as things, not imagined. Real ideas are defined by the dictionary again as derived from sensation and reflection, not imagined or supposed. Knowledge directed or guided by experience without knowledge of principles. So we have this very general discussion, dialectical discussion, between Plato's idealism and Aristotle's empiricism. which is fundamental to my theory.
All right. I want to understand the next step, and then I'll translate.
Okay.
So that this will make a key to understand the drawings and the approach. So
yes.
That I want to understand, and then I will translate.
Yes, it should. I hope.
Yeah.
I hope so. Okay. The notion of the ideal as something imagined is relatable to the concept of a utopia. And a utopia is defined as an imagined place or state of things where everything is perfect. It employs the imaginary to project the ideal, a perfect social, legal, and political system, or place, state, or condition. In contrast to ideal, a utopia can enter the realm of the physical. I had mentioned from Plato, the idea is not physical. It has to become its opposite, its realization. But the utopian proposition is thus quite different from the ideal notion in a significant way. It can be an imagined reality.
Okay. I think I will stop here, otherwise I will get lost myself. So, the slalom works more or less like this. È vero. In italiano. Ok. Allora, dunque, nella prima parte lui ha rafforzato il concetto della stratificazione storica, del contesto, dell'importanza del contesto in cui questi elementi nascono. E quindi diciamo è un proseguo dei concetti già anticipati. Invece adesso lui sta andando in un'altra dimensione che immagino ci servirà a capire diciamo un po' la cucina di questi disegni. Lui, il professor Sporting, ha molto sottolineato questa presenza dell'ideal come qualcosa che non è fatto per essere concretizzato, per essere realizzato, ma che si muove nel termine dell'astrazione sostanzialmente. E, dopo però ha fatto un passaggio estremamente importante, logicamente, in cui ha sottolineato che l'utopia è un territorio interessante, perché l'utopia vuol dire nessun luogo, ma non ha il carattere di astrazione che ha l'ideale, ma che si muove in un territorio di concretizzazione in qualche maniera, ha cominciato a inserire questa cosa che non è l'ideale, ma è qualcosa di diverso. E adesso vediamo quali sono i passi successivi del ragionamento.
Va bene. I have a few quotations which I think are very elegant, so I want to use them. One first is from Lewis Mumford, who wrote a book in 1922 called The Story of Utopias. And he said in this book, I quote, "Almost every utopia is an implicit criticism of the civilization that served as its background. Likewise, it is an attempt to uncover potentialities that the existing institutions either ignored or buried beneath the ancient crust of custom and habit."
Oh, I saw that. I don't understand this word.
Custom and habit.
Custom, okay.
"They most often indict existing society by showing alternatives, sensing both intolerable conditions and enormous possibilities."
Okay.
That's one. And then maybe...
Yeah, vuoi che ti traduco questa?
The next is... from Colin Rowe. In 1959, Colin Rowe published an article called The Architecture of Utopia. In it he stated, and I quote Colin Rowe, "Architecture serves practical ends. It is subjected to use, but is also shaped by ideas and fantasies. Its rationale is cosmic and metaphysical, and here, of course, lay the particular ability to impose itself on the mind." He expressed interest in Carl Mannheim's 1937 book, Ideology and Utopia, whose definition of utopia was that only those orientations transcending reality will be referred to us by as utopian,
okay,
which when they pass over into conduct tend to shatter partly or wholly the order of things prevailing at the time. So those three quotes, which okay. are maybe complicated, but
I miss the third one. Can you tell a keyword in Italian just of that one?
For Mannheim?
Yeah, for Mannheim. You'll do the job.
Mannheim was interested in the dialectic of ideology and utopia.
Okay, good. And the other two, I can note, Lewis Morrison nel 1922 spiega l'aspetto positivo, implicitamente critico dell'utopia, cioè l'utopia serve in qualche maniera da una parte a criticare un esistente e dall'altra a ipotizzare un'alternativa forte all'esistente. Non a caso Mumford è molto interessato anche ai processi reali, sociologico-politici, diciamo, della città. E invece con il Ro, partendo dall'aspetto che la città e l'architettura è fatta per avere risultati pratici, ma questi risultati pratici sono iscritti in un contesto che è un contesto simbolico, trascendente, cosmico.
One of the issues of utopianism is its desire to replace existing presumed reality with another. A critique of utopian propositions is that they cannot simultaneously become real and be ideal. Now, this has been a discussion over since the time of Mumford, at least. And again, quoting Colin Rowe, he says, of a utopian proposition, it may instruct, civilize, and even edify the political society that is exposed to it. It may do all this, but for all of that, it cannot become alive. It cannot, that is, become the society which it changes. And it cannot therefore change itself. However, Mannheim expressed a more dialectical relationship with reality, where a utopian proposition can achieve a reconciliation at another level of truth, requiring a reevaluation or redefinition of itself. If that has an effect, it is changed by its acceptance. This responds to a dynamic rather than static notion of utopia. And this idea, I think, is critical to my theoretical proposition. My argument is simple. In the Renaissance, architects were inventing ideal cities, utopias, but working in the existing medieval city. They worked with the dialectic of developing the ideal piazza, the ideal city, the ideal piazza, the ideal church, the ideal palazzo, on the one hand, and instead of tearing down the existing medieval city or building new ones elsewhere on open land, as I will discuss a little bit later, they sought ways to transform the existing city by insinuating the ideal, the new city, into it.
Okay.
And maybe one last quote from Spiro Kostov. And this is, I think, a nice quote also. Kostov said, "Ideal schemes for perfection, overall forms fade in treatises. Reality forced a respect for built things as long as they were serviceable, as long as they could keep standing. Urban stock was not casually expendable, so the new style had to rely on exemplary accent to make its point."
Okay. So this refers back to the Renaissance way of doing it,
yes.
Right? Allora, ha fatto questa citazione diciamo, dell'operatività rinascimentale in rapporto alle categorie che ha creato, dicendo che da una parte il mondo rinascimentale crea questo ideale, ha l'ideale della piazza, l'ideale del porto, l'ideale della chiesa, l'ideale dello spazio urbano, ma allo stesso tempo riesce e vuole insinuare questi nuovi ideali all'interno dei tessuti preesistenti, in particolare della città medievale. e questa citazione di Spiro Kostov rafforza questo concetto in una forma molto, molto densa in un inglese molto bello.
Ok, now we get pictures. It's important. In the Middle Ages, theory grew out of practice, but in the Renaissance, practice grew out of critical theory. The interest in antiquity, in Plato and Vitruvius, and their particular descriptions of the ideal city, led many Renaissance architects to describe and draw ideal schemes. Verbal descriptions by Alberti and Filaretti discuss or imply the society that was to inhabit these cities. Sforzinda, Fra Giocondo's images, Francesco di Giorgio, Scamozzi, and so forth. And also images of a city drawn by people like Peruzzi and Serlio and Piero della Francesca created a theoretical body of proposals that reflect a new conception of urban order and space. So in this group of images, in the top left is the Cesariano drawing, which I used for my cover. I put the four pieces together of Vitruvius's description of an ideal city. And then there are various projects that you probably know of, down to the one on the bottom right, the Palmanova by Scamozzi, which was a realized fortified city. And we get images also of the ensemble of these ideal pieces. The city, the central piazza, the chiesa in the center, the ideal church, and so forth. So in these three images, you can see some depiction of an urban condition, including on the top the palazzi, which have a critical idea about variation in them, which was also a part of Renaissance theory, but depicting the ideal city. And sometimes, and it's probably critical, there are ancient ruins in this city. So on the bottom you can see a baptistry and a coliseum depicted opposite one another. And so within this ensemble of ideal pieces, the city, the church, the piazza, and the palazzo, we have a wealth of actual illustrations. So for the piazza, I have in the upper left the Pompeii, which Vitruvius describes the ideal forum. And we can see from these examples all existing today, pretty much at the top, and in places in Italy that are not just the ideal piazza of a perfect geometry, but also a connection to the information given to us by Vitruvius. So on the second row on the left, we have some of Sforzinda, and then we also have on the bottom Pienza and Vigevano, all in Venice on the right, that are all interpretations of a pure ideal space, but also a space that maybe Vitruvius influenced, reinterpreted in different contexts.
Ok, credo che questo nesso sia abbastanza chiaro. A lui interessa questa dialettica tra il livello dell'astrazione, dell'idealità e il livello della implementazione nelle varie le situazioni urbane, per cui queste cose, questi spazi urbani che ha enumerato possono sempre essere letti su questo doppio registro.
And we have the ideal church, which is much more obvious, and then the top left is again a sort of reference to Vitruvius and some description about ideal situations. But the idea of the centralized church, which is a new concept representing the cosmos, was geometry and nature being connected together. And then there's also the house, the palazzo, the casa, which has not only a desire for perfect in terms of geometry, but also references to the the descriptions of Vitruvius, and the upper left are a diagram of the Pompeian house, but various versions through the Renaissance of interpretations of a perfect building. And also the perfection of the facade that would have geometry and absolute order to express its role in the as a face to the city. Can I go on? Should I go on? So now I'm going to switch to that's all in the first the few chapters of the book, and then I have in the second part of the book a series of case studies, and the first one, which is sort of a bridge between the two, is a speculation of mine. I'm not a historian. I'm an architect. So I don't have to be absolutely correct. I can be speculative. And I state that very clearly in the book.
Well,
yeah. So at the top are what was happening in Rome, or in Italy, when Vitruvius was writing this book, and there was the Castrum plan. In fact, the upper left plan is said to be a drawing taken from Vitruvius. But Vitruvius describes a different kind of city. He doesn't describe the castrum, the orthogonal system. He describes the radio concentric diagram of the city. And why does he do that? And my speculation is that he saw Rome. And most people say Rome is disorganized, intentionally disorganized, and not very clear. But I believe, and from my own arguments, but also I think it's an interesting discussion, that Vitruvius saw Rome with its topography of the seven hills, the hills and valleys with the roads, and the concentric walls around it, as a pure diagram distorted to fit into its context. That it grew from an idea of perfection into something that was fit into its place. As I say, that's speculation because I don't know if anybody else has ever said anything about that. The other important issue about Rome, which is very particular, is Rome was developed in the Renaissance and Baroque times by the papacy. So there was a political structure that evolved rather consistently over time, and these diagrams kind of trace all the way from Niccolo the Fifth to Sixtus the Fifth, and the different popes with their agenda to extend the importance of the church into the city. So the church and the city would become combined as one.
Tanto per puntualizzare di tanto in tanto, alcuni di questi diagrammi sono assolutamente chiari per la cosa che dicevo prima, ci fanno vedere cose che altrimenti non conosciamo, non abbiamo mai visto, la strutturazione dei percorsi papali, della città papale rispetto al potere, rispetto alla trasformazione della città, è una di queste cose che troviamo nel libro.
So, if you can remember, say, the Cesariano diagram, or Filaretti Sforzinda. The church is in the center, or the Piazza Forum in the center. The church is also there. And there's a radio concentric plan. I would say this is a diagram of an ideal city that's been distorted, that maybe someone sat on it and got squashed and moved around. And it was the agenda of the Renaissance and into the Baroque to try to make existing Rome have some, as Kostov said, it would have to happen in pieces, in segments. So the problem is, St. Peter's, way over on the upper left, is supposed to be in the center for an ideal city. And from there, from the church, the things would radiate out.
Yeah.
Or maybe the Campidoglio should also be in the center and things should radiate out. So in the Renaissance, this is a diagram of what the Renaissance did to the medieval fabric in the Campo Marzio to transform the chaotic medieval conditions into a concept of the ideal city.
Mm-hmm.
And over time, St. Peter's, for all the architects from Bramante through Bernini, were moving the front door of St. Peter's so it hit across the Tiber in the Piazza di Ponte. It hits the Castello San Angelo, it comes across, and at the Piazza di Ponte, which I don't have a pointer, it's up there, you can see the streets that start to radiate out into the city of Rome to go to the ancient fabric of the city, but also to connect up the papal routes from San Giovanni in Laterano to San Pietro.
Okay. Questo bellissimo disegno spiega concretamente gli aspetti teorici illustrati precedentemente, cioè questa sorta di processo che c'è tra l'ideale e il reale. Chiaramente la città medievale, stratificazione sulle precedenti, eccetera, non è il campo ideale con questi oggetti messi in vari luoghi, con varie, diciamo, presenze nella morfologia e nel contesto della città per implementare una città ideale. La città ideale del pensiero rinascimentale e la città reale che c'è data presenta una sensibile differenza. E a questo punto però si ingaggia questa sorta di lotta, no? Di ricerca per cercare di avere, diciamo, di tirare la città reale verso una sorta di alcune idealità progressive. Quindi spiegava, per esempio, chiaramente per la città ideale la Basilica di San Pietro dovrebbe essere al centro, mentre noi sappiamo che è completamente decentrata. Allora attraverso questo si legge anche una serie di sforzo progressivo per far riassumere o ricreare alcune centralità, tra cui non soltanto, diciamo, l'avanzamento progressivo della basilica verso il fatto baricentrico, ma anche la creazione, per esempio, del piccolo tridente del Castel Sant'Angelo, eccetera. E questo comunque è uno di questi disegni molto, molto espressivi e molto forti, molto chiari del libro.
This is a similar diagram of these the routes through the Campo Marzio from San Pietro. And then the second part of the book, as I mentioned, are case studies. So I take sort of critical places in the city of Rome and try to document them in terms of this idea. This is not quite the same as the page in the book, but it has the same pieces. There's always a figure ground drawing, so one kind of common denominator was to do a black and white plan of the area under investigation. I also included some critical images at the top. I chose Giuseppe Vasi over Piranesi because I think Vasi captured the spatial conditions, not so much the perfection that Piranesi's engravings have. And in the center of this page, you can see my diagrams of St. Peter's going from a perfect space, a church in the center of a circular piazza, to a church on the side of the piazza, which is the second one down, to the church extended through Bernini to the Castello San Angelo. And then the fourth one is much like the figure ground drawing, where it becomes the real condition. So the ideal is at the top, and the real is four steps, although it could be any number, but I chose four as a common method. The other parts on the right are more architectural analysis of the space. I think we know that urban design is making the space more than making the building. The buildings become how to make the space. So most of the architectural analysis is about the um, the space, but also the contextual complexity. Because one of the things I would say about Rome, what Rome demonstrates, is that the ideal is rather boring compared to its transformation to the real. The complexity of the real is more interesting, but it needs to contain the concept of the ideal. So these are a series of drawings. And the students that I took, I mentioned in the beginning that I took to Rome in the 70s and 80s, made these drawings. These were all handmade drawings by students. So this
Ink on Mylar
drawings. And the most important, I think, are the lower left, the sections that show issues that you don't quite understand in your experience of it. So now I go on a sequence through. Then I go to the Campidoglio. The figure ground is at the bottom. The images at the top. This interesting on the middle left of Edmund Bacon's diagram of the space before and the space after. So does the geometry of the oval come from the mind of geometry, or is it because the context already implied a certain condition that Michelangelo referred to? And then on the right, the transformation diagrams. And again, the drawings by the students. And again, I think the sections are the kind of elegant piece on the lower left. A second part of my idea about the radial concentric Campo Marzio is that there's a whole sequence which is a concentric sequence that goes from the Tiber River to the Tiber River across the Campo Marzio. And it's a Renaissance sequence of Palazzo Farnese, the Cancelleria, Palazzo Massimo, Palazzo the Piazza Navona, and the Palazzo Altemps, which all make a sequence of urban space, which all as a curve refer back to the Piazza di Ponte at the where St. Peter's crosses the river. And I trace those, and I'll go sort of quickly. This is the Palazzo Farnese, the figure ground, the ideal to real diagrams down the middle, and the architectural analysis, formal spatial analysis on the right, and the student drawings of Farnese in its context, the section, again, kind of wonderful section on the bottom that goes through the Via Giulia up to the piazza, through the building. And my favorite building, the Cancelleria, which has a very interesting urban condition because there's the cortile and there's the church side by side, the void and solid, and the void aligns with the urban context. So the street coming through from the bottom of the figure ground diagonal to the top is from the Farnese, and the intercepts the Cancelleria, where spatially you can, if the French opened the doors to the Farnese, you could see the two cortiles from this intersection. And again, the student documentation. Piazza Navona, that you all know for sure. And the third segment of my analysis, after the Campo Marzio, the two pieces, the radio and the concentric, is going up on the hills that principally Sixtus the Fifth did, but a number of the popes started around the Santa Maria del Popolo and Santa Trinita at the northern end. So this diagram, which is fairly common, shows the pilgrimage churches with the Corso, the existing Corso that Raffaello worked on, but also going, interestingly, in a very conceptual way, up and down the hills on a straight line to Santa Croce and Gerusalemme. But and I also included the Colosseum because Sixtus V wanted to make that into a wool factory, so that was a very important urban project, not to do with the pilgrimage. But so this goes through similarly. This is the Piazza da Popolo, the transformation drawings of ideal to real, some of the interesting things, the topography, and I think the two sections by the students are very interesting, because from the Pincio cascading down into the piazza and going over to the river, which wasn't quite realized by Valadier.
The two churches are very interesting in terms of ideal, the real.
Yes.
Utopian, not utopian. It's a masterpiece of that thinking.
A little example.
It's a little microcosm about the thinking.
Yeah, there are many of these, I think. And Piazza di Spagna, where it had to take up topography, the issue was couldn't go straight, as Sixtus V wanted to do, so the Spanish steps are the solution to a shift, vertical shift and a lateral shift from Piazza del Popolo to Santa Maria da Maggiore. And again, I was most in love with those sections of the Piazza di Spagna. Santa Maria Maggiore, which was Sixtus V's church, so he put it in the middle of the road, and it was facing away from the center of the city. So the Renaissance Baroque project was, how do we turn the front to the city? And when I first came to Rome, you could go up the back steps and go in the two transept doors and be in the church from the obelisk and the back side. So, in fact, the program for Santa Maria Maggiore was to make it two faces, because it had to relate to the ideal diagram of the city. Sections. And lastly, San Giovanni in Laterano, where the same thing happened. The church is facing towards the wall, away from the city. So the transept becomes the entrance from the city. The Sixtus V put the obelisk at the transept and not at the front. So the piazza is made to the side of the church with the baptistry. And the program is the building, but it's also the connection of the building, not just to the city, but to this, I think, concept of the structure of this distorted ideal condition. And that. So, let me end with, maybe before I get to that, I'll stay there for a moment. Rome's urban formation and transformation is foremost an idea for the practice of making urban design. It proposes a methodology that involves the dialectical process or discourse between ideal or utopian thinking and real making or development within the existing city. As such, it implicitly argues that a utopian proposition about contemporary urbanism may be formulated as a critique or rejection of the problems of the present ideological beliefs as evidenced in our culture, social, economic, and political, and physical conditions. We need to understand and analyze this and to step outside of existing conditions to envision a more perfect situation. This dream can be realized, but not literally, for several reasons. For one, it requires removal of the existing, which has obvious impossibilities or possibly terrible consequences. There have been two proposed urban agendas, I think, since the 19th century. One has been to tear down the existing city, and the other has been to replace the existing city. The tear down came from modern urbanism, with Le Corbusier, Villeradius, and CIAM to believe that there's a better way to make the city, and you could make it in some pieces that would slowly take over the historical city. This had terrible consequences in the United States. The middle image is, this is Boston, where the urban renewal program, the American federal government urban renewal program, was to tear down the bad neighborhoods in the center of the city and replace it with modern prototypes. So I think we've had a continuous legacy from the 1920s through, deconstruction, the postmodern deconstruction of Rem Koolhaas on the right, as examples of the idea to replace the city, because the city could no longer function properly and needed to be renewed in a different way than I proposed all afternoon. The second proposal of modernism is Ebenezer Howard's Garden City, to let the city disintegrate, to go away, and make a new city outside someplace. So the Garden City became a new idea for modern urbanism. And that also had strong consequences, particularly in the United States. We have Radburn on the upper right, the Garden City of the 30s and 40s, and Seaside, which is a late 20th century project on the bottom, all of which are not stating it so clearly, but if you look at some of the diagrams of Ebenezer Howard, you see the city in the distance kind of look like it's burning down, and the new Garden City is replacing it. I'll stay on that image for a moment. Alternatively, in the dialect proposed, the ideal has to be insinuated into the existing in such a way as to both maintain an essential continuity with the past and to transform the existing into a more appropriate contemporary city conditions. The theory of contextualism is concerned with transforming the existing city into a contemporary functioning city by understanding through analysis the existing physical context in order to build on and transform its structure. Also to be progressive by analyzing and transforming the present ideological conditions, the social, cultural, economic, and political context, and postulating a better world, a utopia, and transforming that into real or realizable proposals by this dialectic of ideal and real. So I end, if one interprets ideal proposals as diagrams, which are not intended to be built, but are rather to, as Rowe said, instruct, civilize, and edify the normal growth, change, and transformation processes of the city, then the effects of these proposals can be viewed in relation to problems of the existing city and create a transformed new city growing from the old.
Thank you.
Mi sembra che con le immagini e con lei è tutto abbastanza evidente. Sono aperte domande, osservazioni, interventi. Comincia il professor Pulini, se vuole avere un... prego, professor Barbera. Vuoi venire qui, così viene anche registrato l'audio e viene anche ripreso.
First of all, I want to thank you very much. I did not see the book, so from this moment on I'm really eager to read
it. Il libro è da qualche parte.
Yeah, 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 I would buy it.
No, ma arriva. Una copia in giro. Aspetta, la mia, vorrei che sparisse.
I hope that you can continue your studies. I don't know if you have seen some students to follow you, I don't know. I would do a second edition of your cross-sections through Rome, because as Pulini said, maybe Pulini said there is a, you know, Piranesi is not very well represented. But I would say that from what I saw, not only is the up Because you pronounce the name, many times the name of Vasi, you presented also Piranesi, Vasi, Piranesi, they all work around Piranesi. And I think it is not very the cross sections, because you make it clear that Rome is at least a two-level town, and a very interesting identity of Rome is that in all the ages, even in the Roman ages, the problem was how to pass from the upper level to the down level. And the history of Rome produced masterpieces like Piazza di Spagna, like Campidoglio, like the Trajan Market. So there is a sort of coastline, a very, very high coastline. But there is a second coastline, and now it appears. It is the real coastline of the river. So that there is this very, you know, there's a sort of coastline, this step from Campobasso to Esquilino, that was treated architecturally. But in Nonica, there was the second coastline, the jump from the Campobasso to the river. And of course, the water was going up and down, going up. Well, but I think in those cross sections, if you refer to the present state, for instance, the cross section from Pincio to, and then there is the embankment that cancels everything. So there is also another cross section. Even the itinerary from the river through Piazza Navona and so on, it finished in two different points of the coastline. So at the end, look, that very straight line is the cancellation of the real project.
Mm-hmm.
And it is not very difficult to reconstruct, because with Nolan plan, with Vasi and later Lui drawings, I think in a second edition, I'd like to see your students comparing first of all to understand the original project, then to comparing the damage or maybe the newerity, the modernity of the present and very, very, very strong section that equalizes all the. So, with your finesse and with your passion for this town, I really hope that you can go on.
Me too.
Thank you very much.
I was thinking of Istanbul, but maybe I should stay in Rome. I was thinking of going to Istanbul, but maybe I should stay in Rome.
Prego. Sì, facciamo, io direi, facciamo un po' di interventi, poi lui risponde, facciamo un po' a gruppi, andrei a bunch.
Io avrei molte cose da chiedergli, ma volevo porre una sola questione, una sola domanda. Il libro e anche la sua lezione riguarda sostanzialmente gli aspetti costruttivi della città, come è ovvio per gli architetti. Però anche gli architetti sanno che nella città esistono anche fenomeni opposti, cioè di tipo distruttivo, che corrispondono a come gli aspetti costruttivi alla costruzione dell'identità architettonica di una città. Per questo chiedevo come mai la presenza di Piranesi non è forte nel suo libro. Piranesi, ad esempio, con il suo Campo Marzio, esercita una critica radicale sia alla città storica, la città romana, sia alla città che lui rappresentava nelle sue prospettive. fine, con le sue decisioni. In che modo, quindi, secondo lei, questi due aspetti possono essere inclusi in un ragionamento che in qualche modo li consideri entrambi necessari? Perché anche molte di queste, diciamo, architetture costruttive sono nate attraverso la distruzione di antichi ordini urbani, tracciati, edifici, eccetera. Quindi questi due momenti, secondo me, che sono stati separati dalle teorie moderne, come possono essere, diciamo, inclusi in una visione che sia in qualche modo più realistica? Quindi quella coppia su cui l'Impero è costruito, ideale e reale, dovrebbe nel reale, nel polo della realtà, includere anche questi aspetti, diciamo appunto, distruttivi, che a mio avviso sono un alimento fondamentale per l'immaginario urbano. Quindi voglio soltanto citare un autore che da questo punto di vista può insegnare molto all'architettura e agli architetti, che è Ballard. Cocaine Night è un romanzo in cui la teoria della necessità del male come strumento per costruire il bene della città e della comunità urbana è molto evidente. Quindi sarebbe interessante leggere un ulteriore capitolo del tuo libro in cui questo rapporto bene-male della città fosse, sulla scorta della profezia pitagoriana, fosse, diciamo chiaro, fosse presente. Faccio un altro esempio di teoria distruttiva implicitamente. Roger paragona la città a una foresta, ma la foresta che lui ha in mente non è la foresta vera, è il parco di Versailles, fatto dalle notte, che era un luogo di caccia e quindi di morte. Quindi l'immagine che sta dietro il trattato di Roger è un'immagine che ha a che fare con la violenza. Di nuovo la capacità distruttiva, la possibilità distruttiva entra nella determinazione della città, soprattutto di quella moderna. Anche Santeria ha fatto, ha creato immagini sostanzialmente violente, sostanzialmente costruttive, se guardiamo per esempio le sue, diciamo, le sue case, questa sua idea delle case senza più scale, solo ascensori, un'idea sostanzialmente distruttiva dei percorsi, delle relazioni. Bene.
Help me. Yes. Yes. Well, facciamo un primo giro o c'è un altro intervento che vuole, diciamo, aggiungere un poco di suspense? Allora, I want to add an important point, political point, academic political point, going with my theory that when we are more than 10, every action is also a political action. And the axioma that I want to share with you is the following. It goes with one aspect of your talk. And this is very important. It has to do with Colin Rowe, this type of book, the fact that the type of people that is in this room, like Barbera, Furini, etc. So the axioma is the following. The historian lie, let him think that they say the truth. This is a very important statement for me. When I say that the historian lie, let him think that they say the truth, is a very important point. Because the discipline out of which the political lie goes since all the time through history. It's history that is the place of lying. Exactly the contrary of what the historian want to tell us. Because the historian says we are objective. all our thing. It is about objectivity. And it's about this type of lie that the political power, the sociological power, goes on. And that is really so important when you put it at the extreme. So a way of looking at the past of this city with the lens, the so-called objective lens of the historians, are those that I will tell you, ha ha ha, that's the reality, so that is the thing to go. Going back to Piranesi, Piranesi was exactly going mad in a certain moment of his life because that was this Greekization, this neoclassicization of Rome, going exactly with that type of construction is a completely huge lie, and he was getting crazy about that. This lying of being a Greek word in Rome while Rome is completely opposite. And that was exactly with that process. So the first part is, let's be very cautious, but because we are basically designer, with this thing that we are under the sword of the historians, that they say the truth, they are objective. They say generally lie, because that is their status, is why they are in society. Okay, first part. Second part of the axioma that I want to share with you, because we're doing politics here, is the architect tells the truth, telling you that he's telling a lie. Now, because we have as architects many truths, many possible truths simultaneously operating and making things they are partial truths, but they are partial truths of the reality, are the partial truths of the way that life engages with reality. So in a way, the truth is the truth of the choice, is the truth of the deep engagement of us with reality. And we are shy in a way, saying, okay, we are telling you, lies, and the historian says the truth, but it's the opposite. The reality goes with this jump and engagement into reality. That's why I love so much the intervention of Lucio Barbera, because here, Lucio Barbera, it's 35 years that you're doing these dialogues. So we are used to, we are good players. We know how to play with each other. So we've done so many times. I know why he's doing that thing, because he's working on Nolli, of course. Mm-hmm. That's the trick behind. So he's describing his book, telling with the artificial, with the rhetorical artifice, to tell you have to do it, he's doing, or he wants to do it. Now, that this idea that he explained, which is exactly the type of truth that is what we care of the designer. This idea that the sectional layers of Rome are more than one, and there is this natural layering of Rome at the lower level with the river, implying the others in a kind of cross-sectional, much more complex, that is written in Nolens and goes on, is a piece of that truth that I'm interested in. Then I can go and build on that. The same exactly thing, the same exactly rhetoric artifice is what is doing Purim, of course. He is describing his city. The city in which this strong sense of contrast and this strong sense, he used the word violence, you know, mentioning things, etc., etc. And of course, we know all is the poetic of Purini, and now this idea is a sequence of things that brings to a particular idea of formatting, a particular form of architecture, etc., etc. So, this is what we're talking about. They are projecting on you in a very sophisticated rhetorical way, in a way, what they are doing.
Good.
I don't know if that helps or not.
It makes us all bigger. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Ci sono qualche altra domanda e poi ho qualche altro intervento in italiano e in inglese, prego. Facciamo un altro giro, io direi. e poi facciamolo concludere, va bene? Quindi preparatevi a fare un intervento, se ne avete piacere, e poi daremo a lui la parola per chiudere, al professor Sforzi.
Volevo chiedere una cosa rispetto a questo rapporto tra reale e ideale. Pier Frankens, nel libro Lo stato figurativo dal Rinascimento al Buddismo, sostiene una cosa che mi ha visto molto interessante. Dice: la città del Rinascimento è stata prima rappresentata e poi costruita. Cioè, le tavolette di Urbino, di Baltimore, che abbiamo visto qua rappresentate, in effetti sono state rappresentate, disegnate, prima che la città fosse riformata nel Rinascimento. Mi chiedo se questo può essere sostenuto teoricamente, diciamo, nelle trasformazioni che nel tempo le città hanno subito. Cioè, se possiamo pensare che questo dispositivo, come dire, operativo della rappresentazione nella trasformazione della città, funziona anche, per esempio, nel Settecento, nell'Ottocento, fino alla modernità, e forse anche oggi, se il problema della rappresentazione viene prima della costruzione della città. Teoricamente è possibile sostenere queste cose.
Ok, perfetto. Se non hai capito, ti traduco. Hai capito?
No, I will translate.
Ci sono altre domande? O altri interventi che avete piacere di fare? Prego. Prego, Giulia.
Dunque, sempre sulla questione reale, ideale, nei suoi disegni quello che vedo è sicuramente, diciamo, una base in realtà molto concreta, perché tutto parte da osservazioni, da disegni che partono dalla città costruita, dalla città così com'è. Vedo alterazioni di misure, di dimensioni, di spazio, cioè tutto è in realtà descritto rispetto a come la città di Roma si presenta realmente. Mi sembra che il dato invece di ideale che viene aggiunto in questi disegni sta nella selezione che si fa degli elementi contenuti nella città, quindi in qualche modo, diciamo, l'elemento riduzionista, il fatto di ridurre in qualche modo la complessità della realtà, permette di far emergere un grado di complessità nascosta, quella che lei diceva, quella che il professor Saggio diceva, appunto, una struttura nascosta. Questa struttura nascosta è possibile osservarla soltanto grazie ad una lente interpretativa che procede, secondo me, per riduzione, secondo me, con quello che questi disegni mi dicono. Quindi, principalmente, un'azione interpretativa che non è inventiva, ma è inventiva perché seleziona determinate cose, quindi l'invenzione sta lì. Mentre questo appunto sulla base della città reale, mentre invece secondo me il dato di, diciamo, il contenuto ideale di questi disegni sta nel fatto non tanto che manca il luogo, perché il luogo c'è e come, quindi sono senz'altro utopici, ma manca l'uomo in effetti, cioè quello che mi sembra, almeno scorrendo il libro e vedendo questa presentazione, non c'è mai l'aspetto percettivo di questi spazi urbani. Quindi lo spazio, la prospettiva banalmente manca sempre. Quindi una domanda che vorrei fare è, visto che so che è sicuramente una scelta ben ragionata, come mai la prospettiva è fuori?
Bene. È l'ultimo chance di fare un intervento, se vi fa piacere, prego.
Della costruzione della città di campo come due nozioni, no? Progressive, che è data da stratificazioni temporali, sicuramente, ma è data anche da temporali orizzontali, ma è data anche da stratificazioni progressive di espansione, no? Graduale su territori, a partire dal centro storico fino alla periferia. Però in questa crescita Roma è una città che è cresciuta da quindi oltre che, diciamo, al rapporto economico tra ideale e concreto e reale, che non è fondamentale la forma tra pieno, tra la forma del pieno e la relazione del luogo. Allora mi sono chiesta, ascoltando la reazione del professore, se c'è una parte del suo studio che riguarda la città Sistina.
La città?
La città Sistina, quindi ah. Invece sono che fanno è simbolo, diciamo, la grande mano della grande struttura, quella che poi sarà questa struttura, però simbolo di ciò che si vede in morale e se l'analisi che si era fatto tratta anche questo tema del rapporto con il cuore di Dio.
Sì, certo, ok.
Io sono Stefano Aragona, sono ricercatore di Banifica, e prima abbiamo avuto modo di cambiare qualche parola, e ero un po' sinistro, vedevo un rapporto tra etica ed estetica in qualche modo, no? Dato che si parla di città ideale, no? E allora ero interessato, io ho studiato precedente il testo, mi sembrava interessante, no? Allora ecco, volevo avere qualche
Okay. I will shortly translate with the full intervention and then you decide how to answer to them.
Okay.
Is that okay? Allora, the first question is about let's say the pilaster. The pilaster of, no, I think this one. The pilaster by Pierre Francastel, lo spazio del Rinascimento al Cubismo, no? In particular, it was mentioned the fact that thinking about the Renaissance city, that Renaissance city was imagined before. That was the specific question. If that is the same thing for the other type of cities, they were always drawn before, what do you think about that? So that is number one. Now, number two, Giulia, no? I think so. Allora, Giulia said... she noticed the process of reduction by knowledge, or knowledge by reduction, let's put it like this, of the approach that you were doing, and noticing that she was thinking that from her point of view, what appears to her critical is the lack of a contextual perspectival drawing in the thing. And then she assumed that decision is very strategic. And if you'd like to elaborate on that part a bit. Poi dicono le persone universitarie non lavorano. Then there is the other question by Cecilia. Architect Anselmi pointed out the issue of temporal limits, and I think you intended chronological limits, until in which moment for you stops your type of analysis, yeah? And then if this temporal limit, chronological, no, intendi dire, if that chronological limit has a specific meaning on one side. On the other side, she was mentioning the fact that in all the processes, temporal, diachronic, or chronological, of expansion and conquering of the outside spaces, the real role of empty space seems to be crucial within the structure of the city, because in some way this from an extreme dense city of the Imperial Rome, we went up to a very low dense city of the medieval time, to a reappropriation. So that issue of conquering of space or relationship with empty space seems to be very important to her, and she would like that you develop a little bit on this point. And then the last question of our colleague in city planning, he is of course interested in a possible dialectic between the ethical, political level and let's say, the formal aesthetical level of your analysis and book, if this is out by purpose or whatever, you can elaborate on that. Thank you. Sì, avvicina il microfono, per favore, così loro sentono meglio.
Well, these four questions could make four more lectures, maybe. But I think the first two are kind of related about issues of drawing. I mentioned one distinction between the Renaissance and the medieval that knowledge followed making in the medieval and knowledge preceded making in the Renaissance, so that you could, I mean, it's an interesting notion of when could you draw a something that doesn't exist. And one of the things that, I mean, there are lots of drawings, and there are probably many missing drawings before the Renaissance, but clearly in the Renaissance, the process of thinking through a problem and then being able to draw it. So you have an idea about making a plan, and you draw the plan and then you build it. It was relatively new, I think. Again, I make excuses of not being a historian. But, I mean, that's an interesting point where I think in the Renaissance, the whole notion of utopian thinking could happen, that you could actually draw ideas. Second question about perspectival, or I would also maybe add citesque, you know, Camille Cité, talking about the city as a kind of scenographic method of discussion of the city, versus a more analytic one, which I think would be the Noli plan. The Noli plan, which I think starts to talk about the last question a bit too, but the idea about making a plan to be able to understand a building or a city. I mean, Le Corbusier said the plan is the generator, clearly a plan or a section is much more abstract than a scenographic view. But it's also more complex and pervasive, because a scenographic view is a point. And it is interesting, in the Baroque times they were very interested in the view from a point, and that's a whole other area of investigation. But I chose, probably would have done more if I had more work from the students, more axonometrics. But an axonometric is more like a plan than it is a pictorial view. So it was intentional that I chose a more abstract method of looking at the city, which maybe goes to the fourth question about ethical issues. And the Noli plan was a critical part of my education. As students, we all had a Noli plan on the wall. It was in the studio. It was a very important document. Even still teaching, they say, make a Noli plan, even though the students aren't exactly sure what that is. But the interesting thing about the Noli plan is, I think, not only is it this beautiful, accurate map of Rome, but it's a very interpretive one, because the public buildings are drawn in plan like they're part of the space. They're part of the spatial sequence of the city. So not just public buildings, but cortile, insides of churches and stuff are drawn in plan, where I believe Noli felt they were part of the urban realm and not part of the fabric of the city, or that they were in this kind of limbo between the fabric. I love this Italian word, tessuto, of the city, and so I think that's an interesting example of a drawing that has ethical content in some way, or is talking about the city in particular ways. Being an architect, my specialty is talking about space and building. But I do think the contextual issue, the idea of understanding the context of the city, has to go over political, social, cultural issues as well. And at that point, then you have to start to take a position, a political decision about things, because your drawing can have political content. But how to analyze a political context architecturally, I'm not quite capable. It would be a wonderful idea, and I think it would be worth trying to do, but it's complicated. And maybe that goes to the temporal, what caught my eye was empty spaces. I mean, I think of urban design as the designing of the void, and never think of them as empty spaces. In a figure ground, in fact, I didn't put them in the book, but we did a lot of figure ground reversals, because if the city is made up of voids that are solid, in a sense, that the space is the solid of the cities, then Gestalt psychology sort of has told us that we tend to see black as the figure and the white as the void. So if you take a city and you draw the space black and the buildings white, you reverse the thinking about the city of solids and just think about the city of voids. I think that's sort of critical to what using Rome as my case study.
Mm-hmm.
And Rome is I couldn't do just any city. Rome was important for me because it was the quality of the voids that make the public realm.
Very good.
I don't know. I got all four.
Yeah. I'd like to conclude and thank you very much, Drew. But by telling which I have the honor to invite you and to put these arguments on the board, I'd like to conclude with what culture is. Now, culture and the relationship between culture and politics, which is one of the major drama of this city in this particular moment. So if culture is for us, as architects, the capability to critical understanding the past, and out of that critical understanding of the past, being able to build a future. Culture is an operative attitude. It is not summing up things. It's to select and orient. And the issue of culture and the capability to move in an active way what culture is strictly related to the critical understanding of one side and the possibility to build upon that a decision of the future. So the examples that you are mentioning are just clearly, we are in a city that is completely disoriented right now, has basically no whatever orientation. It does not understand what's going on, because they are missing basic understanding of cultural values, exactly, and I want to mention two that you just mentioned. What does it mean to plan to have a treasure of this city as only designed as a sequence of open spaces that arrive up to the center? Means, for example, that the Pantheon is clearly a key element of the sequence of the experience of Rome, because of the sequence it goes from empty space, urban space, to the inside space, to outside space again. The fact to have political put it a ticket there and created an artificial barrier clearly shows the fact that this society is completely disoriented. has no understanding of what culture is in exactly the way that I was telling. And the other thing that you mentioned about Santa Maria Maggiore is exactly the same thing again. Since several decades has been cutted the possibility to understanding the very essence.
Yes.
We are talking of the very essence of the transformation of Santa Maria Maggiore, as we just expressed. That meaning that that's why we need people that work on culture, work with a critical understanding and with the capability to engagement in reality. And that's why I don't care, or I care very partially, to a theological infinite understanding of papers, label about history, and not the understanding that we are breaking very important values, cultural values, just by the fact to put a fence in that thing. But in order to understand why to put a fence, create all that, we need culture. We need understanding, we need critical understanding, we need your type of work. So I thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks. Thank you. Just one last word. Yeah. I want to thank Antonino Saggio and Franco Purini for having the chance to meet them in New York and to invite me back to Rome. And when I was doing the book and finished, I was always wondering, what are Italians going to think about this guy coming from America to talk about their city? And it's actually been very nice for me to see that it's received, that it has some value to the people who are really yep. living here and looking at it carefully and students, the product of being in Rome. So I'm pleased to have a nice reception in Rome.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks, Eric. Thanks again. Thank you. If you record it, I will send you the record. I also video record.
Oh, yeah, great. Mm-hmm.